Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. While the all-important midterm elections are mostly over, and the fate of the country and the world still hang in the balance as we await the final outcomes in Arizona, Nevada, California, and in Georgia, where there'll be a runoff election between incumbent junior Senator Raphael Warnock and philandering former footballer Herschel Walker, a man who can barely form a coherent sentence, yet who has attracted the support of just under 50% of Georgia voters, mainly because he's not Raphael Warnock. Ohio and Florida deepened their blood-red political hue, sending far-right Governor Ron DeSantis back to his mansion and far-afield venture capitalist J.D. Vance to the Senate. But overall, Democrats fared better than expected and may hold the Senate. Abortion rights bills passed in every state where they were on the ballot, and a few embattled governorships were kept from the hands of Trump-endorsed far-right characters. The so-called red wave that typically follows a Democratic presidential victory was far smaller than predicted, and analysts are describing the Republican Party as being in disarray. What that means and whether or not that's true is a matter of some debate, but on the Democratic side, hand-wringing and post-morteming seems to have a relaxed or even slightly triumphant tone. It seems that the election was a referendum of sorts on the kind of extremism and gutturalism that characterized the Trump camp. But will a small number of Republicans, if freed from the oppressive constraints of the old party stricture, the propensity to punish Republicans who fail to toe the line for the Führer, will they cross the aisle to support even just a few reforms from the Biden administration? Might we see a federal minimum wage increase or an expansion of Medicare, renewable energy incentives, or the closing of corporate tax loopholes or two? Keep in mind that the Trump cult base is still active, and keep in mind that even the seemingly moderate Republicans have voted in lockstep for the worst of Republican policies for many years. Keep in mind also that in Ohio, more than 50% of the voters elected J.D. Vance, who identifies with Trump. The problem will not go away overnight, or without being confronted. Ohio's Democratic senatorial candidate Tim Ryan is being praised for having run a good campaign, but did he? He tracked to the right, appealing to fence-sitting independent voters and former Trump supporters, while taking for granted his traditional base and thumbing his nose at progressives. His social media funding appeals were embarrassingly poor and repetitive, and he barely campaigned in the major metro areas. Will Democrats follow this example and move further to the right, or will they double down on progressive policies that expand civil rights, protect the environment, and expand social services? And how much of that depends on social justice movements? Clearly, we remained organized and energized around a handful of issues, but are we prepared to keep up the pressure on the Biden administration to remain committed to at least the goals set forth in the Build Back Better plan? Meanwhile, there is still a war in Ukraine, and a clattering of metaphoric sabers in the Koreas and the makings of a revolution in Iran. But progressive electoral winds have swept a portion of Central America, possibly forcing the U.S. to revise its foreign military and trade policies there in time. The news generally is not all that bad, and inflation in the U.S. is slowly declining. We have a post-election analysis from Crystal Ball in the first part of the show, and a recent interview with former Ohio Congressperson Dennis Kucinich about the situation in Ukraine and the U.S. role there. He was interviewed just a few days ago by former Democracy Now! Producer Aaron Maté. We'll start with Crystal Ball.
Just to start at the top, here's basically the lay of the land. The red wave, I'll steal from Ben Shapiro. I don't often quote Ben Shapiro, but he said
we can quote him in this instance.
The red wave turned into a red wedding.
Game of Thrones reference for the uninitiated.
I mean, listen, Republicans still likely to hold the House. Mm-hmm. But as I said, actually in doubt. As of this morning, in terms of races that are called, they have only netted overall one seat. That is way below where they expected to be at this point. I mean, I never thought we'd be going into this morning not sure of where the House is ultimately going to land.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah. In terms of the Senate, big news overnight, John Fetterman declared victorious in the state of Pennsylvania. That means Democrats are actually up a seat because that was a Republican-held seat. He outperformed Biden in effectively every part of the state. There's a lot to say about that. We'll save that for a moment. what's still outstanding? You still have Nevada, where you have a lot of Clark County mail-in ballots. Nobody knows how much still outstanding. Right now, the Republican has an edge. Will he ultimately hang out on there? Big question mark. In Arizona, it looks like Mark Kelly is going to hold on there. He's got a pretty sizable margin based on what we know about where the votes are still out. Looks like he's going to be able to pull it off. Georgia, Warnock has now pulled into a lead, but is below that 50% threshold to avoid a runoff. Now, there is some vote still outstanding. There is a still theoretical possibility he could get beyond that 50% vote. But if that one, let's just say that one heads to a runoff, then you're looking at Nevada and Arizona. Republicans have to hang on in Nevada, which they might, in order to gain control of the Senate. So you have some really, you know, wild situations here, and much, much better night than Democrats expected. You know, a lot to say about how this was a sort of repudiation of the Trump direction of the Republican Party, a lot to say about how this was really a result of Roe versus Wade being overturned and incredible Democratic enthusiasm, very unusual for a midterm election. And the last thing I'll say, Sagar, and then I'll get your sort of like big picture takeaways, and I'll give mine. You did have regional variation these results unfolded, which made this election so weird, because the first results we got in were Florida, and it was like, oh my God, this looks like the red wave bloodbath. Then we start getting in New Hampshire, and we're like, wait a second, Maggie Hassan is dramatically outperforming Joe Biden in New Hampshire, dramatically outperforming the polls. Then you had New York also was kind of strong for Republicans, not as good as they thought they were going to do there, but they actually picked off a few Democratic seats there. So a lot of regional variation, a lot of like candidate variation, a lot going on that made this a very complex election night.
Absolutely. So a couple of top line things. Number one, obviously the red wave did not materialize in any way. And to be clear, House and Senate still very much could go Republican, given the outstanding results right now in Arizona and in Nevada. But I think regardless of that, given how the toss-ups in the House, which we will get to in a little bit, did not go in the Republican direction, given really the fact that the Democratic base showed up big time, this is one of the most extraordinary midterm elections absolutely of my lifetime and in modern history. Joe Biden has just shored up his position at the Democratic base. This changes politics on a macro level in a way that I did not, nobody anticipated, I can say that. And I will say also that given the national environment that we are in right now, the Republican, quote, soul searching and civil war, which I did not think would materialize, I still think it absolutely will now at this point, and will go into, frankly, into overdrive in the next 2 weeks, especially if Trump also does announce his election. But I have to also say this on abortion, which is that I tweeted this morning just to be a little bit to shiv some people. I see many Republican commentators, Crystal, who are so willing to Trump and candidate quality and all that.
Yeah.
What about abortion? I mean, clearly,
they
don't want to talk about it at all. It is clear as day to me that abortion was one of the biggest deciding factors for the Democratic base for many people who showed up to vote. Number two, the emerging GOP coalition that people were so excited about did not materialize in nearly the same way. Yes, turnout was very high. We were talking this morning. Myra Flores lost down in South Texas. Yep. She also was saying, talking about the red wave, did not materialize. Beto ended up winning many of those South Texas districts. So
yeah, I mean, he lost overall, but we've been covering how much the Rio Grande Valley has shifted.
Exactly.
They shifted back significantly last night, and Henry Cuellar, who also represents the district down there, won, I think, pretty easily. Like you said, Myra Flores ends up losing. That ends up being a Dem pickup in that region, and then Beto at the top of the ticket as governor wins back, outperforms in Rio Grande Valley.
So clearly the takeaway is that GOP in disarray for once. The row your vote strategy actually did work phenomenally
Give them credit.
For the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
But let's not take away an extraordinary event. Florida is now a red state, and not just like kind of red, like red. Ron DeSantis won by 20 points. Marco Rubio similarly won by 17 points.
Yeah.
Extraordinary showing for Republicans in Florida, solidly in the GOP column now. And we have a totally shifting map. I think this is going to be the ultimate war for the quote unquote narrative.
Yeah.
Was it candidate quality? Was it abortion? And was it Trump? So unfortunately, we can't say it's just one thing. I think it's multifaceted in many ways. Extraordinary that Pennsylvania gets called almost immediately. I sent an analysis this morning, Crystal,
yeah.
which shows that John Fetterman is on track to win Pennsylvania by a larger percentage point than Joe Biden in 2020, Trump, or Toomey in 2016. Why is that extraordinary? One of the data points that you and I were pointing to last night was that early exit polls, of which we were both extraordinarily dubious, showed that abortion was at the very top of the ticket, top of mind, even more so than inflation in the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I'm also finding a lot of interest in the fact that the Wisconsin governor's race goes Republican. Michigan, by the way, for the first time in 20 years, is set to have Democratic control of government all the way up and down the legislature and for the governor. So it is clear, given also the ballot initiatives we'll talk about with respect to abortion, I don't think we can understate how much of an impact that it had on the election last night.
Yeah, I mean, the two big obvious things are, number one, abortion.
Yes.
And number two, Trump and election denial.
Right.
Really saddling the Republican Party. I mean, when we talk about the governor's races, there is so far one candidate who might win a governor's mansion, and that would be Carrie Lake, who is an election denier. Mm-hmm. Every single one of the other ones lost.
Yep.
This was an albatross around the neck, not just of the extremist Republican candidates, mm-hmm. but it really was a stench across the entire party. And, you know, some of the candidates that performed the most poorly, like Dr. Oz, were Donald Trump picks.
Absolutely.
You know, down in Georgia, Raphael Warnock, now with an edge, now probably going to a runoff where I would say he's favored to win, but we'll wait and see what the national environment is there. But, you know, picked a very weak candidate in Herschel Walker, who dramatically underperformed Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger, who were running statewide as well. But there are some other factors here that I think are really interesting, too, especially when you look at the regional variation. So Li Fong tweeted this morning, which I thought was an interesting point. He said, you know, Biden, the Democrats really outperformed in the Midwest last night. Mm-hmm. So if you think about Pennsylvania, if you think about Michigan, even in Ohio, there were some, obviously Tim Ryan didn't win, J.D. Vance ends up winning, but there were some surprise flips in congressional districts in Ohio, one of which no one even had on their radar. They thought was a likely R, mm-hmm. and a Democrat ends up winning it. You had strong Democratic performance in Wisconsin as well. And Li Fong points out, listen, Biden did way more to bring back trade from China, invest in post-industrial states with new money for manufacturing, and shore up local governance than Obama did in his first 2 years. Might be part of the reason Dems fared relatively well in Ohio, Minnesota, Michigan, Pennsylvania, etc. So I think the big picture trends, definitely Trump, repudiation of Trump, repudiation of stop the steal, conspiracy, election yes. denying, nonsense and extremism, and also extremism on abortion and other issues as well. But I really do think the election denial thing was a bridge too far for a lot of voters. But I do think you also have to point to some of the policy that Joe Biden enacted in office, in particular in that sparking Democratic enthusiasm. Mm. Young people are a big part of the story of what happened last night.
Absolutely.
You know, they showed up for Democrats. There was a huge generational divide in terms of who people were voting for, young voters overwhelmingly for Democrats. To look at that and say, weed, student loan debt cancellation, that was probably really helpful there. That was a group where Biden was dramatically underwater until he took some of those actions. You look at the Midwest, you know, you see the trade policy, you see the CHIPS Act, you see, you know, continued smart trade initiatives with regard to China. And you say, maybe that was part of the story there in the Midwest as well. So, you know, the top layer is Trump, the top layer is abortion. But I do think underneath the surface, some of the regional variation has to do with some of the actual policy things that Biden enacted in office, which is kind of heartening that, like, real things might actually matter.
I'm not so sure. I still think it's abortion. I think abortion was just so key in Wisconsin and Michigan, especially Michigan, where it was both on the ballot and it was at the state level. The gubernatorial candidate has so much impact, right, especially with control of the GOP legislature. You might be right. Listen, I hope you're right. But I'm not yet convinced.
Well, because before yep. Biden started doing some stuff, his approval rating with the Democratic base mm-hmm. was really kind of
It was low. And they came out to vote.
The big reason right. why this is different from other midterms, Republicans were energized.
Right.
They showed up. But Democrats were, if anything, even more energized. And then I haven't seen the independent numbers yet, but they must not have swung as hard to the right as pollsters were ultimately predicting.
Yeah.
So all of those things, you know, abortion is certainly the spark. But I also think a Biden agenda that the Democratic base that was genuinely like excited about and, you know, affirmatively like supportive of Inflation Reduction Act, all of that coming. I think that also helped to shore up Democratic enthusiasm here. You know, the other thing that I was thinking about is we've had so many election cycles where it just seemed like the laws of political gravity no longer applied. Basically, since Trump won office,
yes.
That just turned every like conventional wisdom narrative about how politics functions and how people vote. It just turned it completely on its head. You're like, you can say grab them by the whatever right. And you can still get elected and have all this fallout from all kinds of elites. You could still get elected. This was the first election where it felt like some of those rules of political gravity applied once again, where it was like, you know what? These people, I might not be in love with what the Democrats are doing, but these people have gone way too far, and I just can't go there with you. And it also marked the return of regional variation, which, you know, especially in the Trump era, every one of these elections has been a national election, national election, national election. We both have been saying, like, local politics mm-hmm. is dead. It doesn't matter anymore. Last night, it did matter, you know, and that really marks a dramatic shift from the Trump era as well. As I said, Republicans really, you know, if you just looked at Florida and New York, you'd be like, ah, they had a pretty good night. In New York, I'm going to talk about this later, which amuses me greatly. It looks like Sean Patrick Maloney, who was the head of the DCCC, it looks like he may well lose his seat. And there's a whole lot to say about mm-hmm. that as well. But, you know, to your point about abortion, in New York, there wasn't a sense that abortion rights were really at risk because you still have a Democratic legislature.
Exactly.
So even if you're sending Republican members of Congress, even if you consider voting for Lee Zeldin as governor, who ended up, you know, losing and losing pretty handily. But, you know, even if you put some Republicans in, people didn't feel like their abortion rights were at risk. And I do think that's part of the story of why New York was better for Republicans.
Right. And no, let's also not forget this. Ron DeSantis, he may be many things, but on abortion, he was only willing to go to 6 weeks.
That's
he
true.
Never endorsed the national ban. True. And I think this is also something that really hurt some of the Senate candidates. So Herschel Walker, his own personal dalliances aside, I mean, Warnock was hammering him, saying if we have a GOP majority, they are going to pass, you know, some national abortion ban. Obviously, Blake Masters didn't do himself any favor having that literally on his website at the time.
Yeah.
And look, let's talk about this. Masters right now is getting clobbered. Like, look, there's only 68% of the vote that is in, but he's running far behind Carrie Lake, who is nearly neck and neck with Katie Hobbs in the same thing. Clearly, there was a lot of split ticket voting and people did not like Blake Masters. That is a very interesting note, of which we can really only assume abortion had to be one of the major deciding ones. Combine that with the ballot initiatives in two quasi, or at least one red state and one purplish state, and we can say definitively that this was a massive, massive drag on the party. So I think that those are the my main takeaway on this, also from a meta level, like on the polling and everything, is we truly don't know anything. And that's very humbling, and I love it. I love being surprised by Americans. I was exactly like you. Frankly, I've just been cynical for the last 6 years. With Trump, like you said, I'm like, listen, man, people, you know, look, you can do anything, and you can't get elected. You know, many of these stop the steal deniers, and even on abortion, you know, people who were willing to go crazy out there, I was like, I just don't think it's going to matter in the context of inflation. But people surprise the hell out of us, and that was my main thing, was obviously completely I was wrong on the red wave. I truly assumed that inflation and all that would trump much more that inflation and all that would trump any concern on social or even stop the steal. And, I'd be willing to empathize and understand with that position.
Yeah.
But clearly it was not enough. And that is a really fascinating takeaway that I have not truly yet grappled with from our election.
I mean, there's a few things I'm thinking about here. First of all, Arizona is an interesting example because Carrie Lake's position on abortion is indistinguishable from Blake Masters.
Right.
But she's
better
just
at saying
a much better candidate. And on the other side, the Democratic candidate, Katie Hobbs, very weak candidate.
Right.
Mark Kelly, very strong candidate. So I think you just have, like, you know, on one hand, the candidate quality is Democrat is very strong and Republican is very weak, and it's exact opposite at the gubernatorial level. We still don't know the outcome of those races. It looks like Mark Kelly is going to hold on. If I had to guess, I'd say probably Carrie Lake ends up winning, but that one is going to be really close and is not anywhere close to being called, and it's probably going to take days because that's just how they ultimately do things. But it is absolutely fascinating to watch all of this unfold. the pollsters got it wrong, but for the first time in several election cycles, it was Dem over performance, right? Especially in the states of New Hampshire. Huge miss there. Huge miss. All of the polls leading up to Election Day were like, maybe Maggie Hassan by one, maybe Don Bolduc by one, maybe by two. And then she blew out. I mean, she outperformed Biden in the state. It's not even close. Pennsylvania is the other one. Huge polling miss in the state of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Now, some of these other states, the mainstream pollsters actually came pretty close. Like Georgia looks like they came pretty close. Looks like Arizona, looks like Nevada, they came pretty close. And then this time it was the partisan right pollsters who were wildly off in some of these states. I mean, you had Trafalgar with Washington state Senate race, Patty Murray, as a toss-up. It looks like she's going to win by 14 points.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is just, and they had a few like that where they were predicting toss-ups in places where Democrats are now going to win by 12, 13, 14 points. So, you know, for them, they have a lot of egg on their face this morning in the same way that the mainstream pollsters did in 2020.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that it's fascinating, right? Because the pollsters got it completely wrong 2016-ish on 2018. If anything, there was some GOP overperformance. 2020, obviously, dead wrong once again. So that obviously that was my baked in assumption. So I was listening to some of the takeaways. Nate Silver did like a snap reaction last night at like 2:30 or whatever in the morning. And he was like, look, here's the truth, which is that we have recency bias. N of four, as in a sample size of four elections, actually not that big. Yeah. So to have one be different than the other three, if you take in the context of the hundreds of elections that we have had in American history, that's actually not a very good data set. It's an important thing that we all need to remember. You know, we had recency bias, I don't think unfairly, from 2016 to 2020.
I think what we looked at was we're like, we don't really trust the polls.
Yes.
That was well-founded.
Yeah.
And so it's like, all right, well, if you can't rely on the polls, what are you going to rely on? And then you go, okay, well, the other thing you can look to that's not just like my gut feeling or my vibes is the fundamentals. The fundamentals were terrible for Democrats.
Right.
The, you know, Biden's approval rating, history of if you're the party in power, the economic numbers, inflation, what people are telling people their number one issue ultimately is. And so when you look at that, you go, I mean, can all of that be overridden by candidate quality issues and abortion? Apparently, the answer is yes. And I do think, you know, for the Republicans, if they had run candidates who like were basically plain vanilla Glenn Youngkin types across the country, they would be in a very different situation than they are in right now. You know, on the inflation piece, I floated this last night, and it continues to be my best guess over why the economic numbers were not the weight around the Democrats that you would think that they would be. And I think it's because voters are kind of realistic about how much to blame, you know, that the president ultimately is for what's going on in the economy. They look at this, they're like corporate profiteering, supply chain issues. We just had COVID, like the whole world was turned upside down. So there's a little bit less blame directly of Biden's policies. And we saw that in some of the exit poll results. And then on the other hand, I think there was also, you know, a miss from Republicans who thought they could just say inflation, inflation, inflation without being really specific about here's what we would do that would help you directly. And so they ended up not benefiting from that to the extent that they thought that they would ultimately.
Let me reiterate a point Ryan Grimm made last night, of which I am now forced to grapple with. I would have told you he was insane 48 hours ago, was that, hey, we live in a crazy economy. Yeah, inflation is high. Savings is really bad. All of that. But we have very low unemployment. So to have that low unemployment, it's a confounding variable. The Biden administration has been talking that way. You know, I've frankly dismissed it as cope, given the savings rate going down, people the way that people feel about it. But maybe it just doesn't hit the same to have high inflation and to have unemployment at four. When let's say unemployment was at 10, I think it would have been it would have been different. It would have been the actual red wave could have materialized. So maybe that's something.
And gas prices still high.
Yeah, 380 right
a
now.
A lot lower than they were before, though.
That's right. About 70 cents less than the overall peak, you know, during all of this. Man, there's so many meta takeaways. You know, I'm also thinking about if the Democrats do hold the Senate, from a foreign policy perspective, you know, we shouldn't forget the war in Ukraine. Like, this basically just greenlit the blank check to Zelensky now for a long time. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
There's also on the House side, if the Dems do capture the House, keep the House, possible, unlikely at this point. Let's say, what, 25% chance?
Something like that.
Then, look, I mean, what are they going to do? That's right. Another good question.
I know.
By the way, nobody in Washington even knows the answer to that question.
Right now, it is still possible Republicans end up with control of the Senate by one seat.
Right.
It is also possible that, if not kind of likely, you know, a little bit more likely than the Republicans ending up with a one-seat margin, it's very possible Democrats end up with a one-seat margin.
Well, the New York Times has it, majority of their needle right now says lean Dem in the Senate. Yeah.
Right. And so, I mean, of course, you know, Democrats have the vice presidency, so they can have a 50-50 and have Kamala Harris as the tie-breaking vote, so they have an advantage there. Also, this could very well be coming down to another Georgia runoff.
Oh, God.
Could very well be coming down to that, which I will say I predicted at one of
my
live shows.
I did
predict that.
You were right.
At least I will be able to take some comfort in feeling like I was right at some point during this process. But, the key is just to make a lot of different predictions, and then you can just be like, that one.
That's what I do. I really throw everything at the wall. I go, yeah, I think this, but here's all the caveats. Listen, I love being wrong about this because it's fun. I love seeing the vote totals. I love seeing the way that people vote. People are not reductive. They are multifaceted.
It's
I think they are their own people. I love America.
And it really does put a lot of pause into the narrative of, you know, realignment inevitability.
Absolutely.
Because we had a sequence of elections where it was like, all right, Latinos move a little more. Latinos move a little more. Oh, now we see Black men moving a little bit this way. And that went in the other direction last night. So it also, you know, I mean, Democrats used to have this very arrogant view of like, demographics are destiny, the coalition of the ascendant. As the Latino population grows, we're just going to automatically benefit from that. And I think Republicans started to engage in a little bit of that same type of thinking of just like, inevitably, these groups are going to continue moving our way. And, you know, we don't really, it's just going to happen. We don't really have to do anything like, you know, economically, we don't really have to deliver for them. We're just like going to fight the culture war and they're going to fall into our hands. And, you know, last night is a real warning sign for the Republicans on that front as well. So the question of what Democrats would do if they end up with the House and they end up with a plus one in the Senate, that would be a really interesting one. Because then you can take Joe Manchin off the table or you can take Kyrsten Sinema off
the table and you can
you know, potentially do another reconciliation thing. But that's getting way ahead of where we are right now. Cable news is ripping us apart, dividing the country, making it impossible to function as a society and making it impossible to know just what is true and what is false. But the good news is they are failing and they know it.
That is why we're building something new, a new mainstream, a healthier one, something more trustworthy, something that we are going to need in one of the most pivotal times in American history. We are building up here for the midterms, for the upcoming presidential election. We're trying to change America for the better and the entire world.
That was Crystal Ball and Sagar and Yeti from their podcast Breaking Points. I trimmed some of the chatty introductions so we could bring you most of the next interview with Dennis Kucinich, interviewed here by Aaron Maté. Kucinich, who once proposed a new federal cabinet post, the Department of Peace, analyzes the U.S. push for conflict as opposed to diplomacy and discusses a letter from the Progressive Caucus to Biden urging an emphasis on diplomacy, a letter that was signed by nearly 40 members of Congress, but which was withdrawn under pressure from the Democratic Party leadership.
Welcome to Pushback. I'm Aaron Maté. Joining me is Dennis Kucinich. He is a former Democratic member of Congress from Ohio and the former mayor of Cleveland. Dennis Kucinich, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Aaron. It's good to be on your show. I look forward to our discussion.
You in Congress led the peace movement inside Congress when you were there over a decade and led the opposition to the Iraq War. And when this debacle just happened with congressional progressives issuing a letter calling on Biden to pursue diplomacy with Russia, not threatening to stop approving military spending for Ukraine, just asking him politely to pursue diplomacy, they withdrew it after 24 hours. And I was just curious, having led the peace wing of Congress when you were there, your response to this debacle.
Well, it's a new chapter in the cancel culture, the progressive congressional caucus looks like it's been canceled. And the efforts, which on their part were rather straightforward yet meek, to ask for diplomacy, were not just casually pushed aside, they were crushed. it's really important for people to understand the significance of what happens when 30 members of Congress sign a letter to the president saying, look, we support you. At the same time, we really feel that we're in a moment where diplomacy needs to be exercised in order to avoid a wider war. Now, when that kind of a very straightforward and mild request by members of Congress gets not just swept aside, but crushed, we all need to reflect on where we're going with this conflict, this war in Ukraine. Because if diplomacy is not even to be talked about or considered, that means we're headed for an escalation and all the consequences.
Based on your time in Congress, what kind of insight do you have in the pressures lawmakers face when they try to take a stance, even a very mild one, as you say, as was the case here, in the direction of peace?
One's susceptibility to pressure generally depends on one's own life and political experience. The less experience you have, the pressure that can happen in Washington can be extraordinary. And it also has to do with one's aspirations to keep moving up in the leadership of Congress. People are vulnerable. I mean, there's no question about it, to pressure that comes, particularly when it is accompanied with characterizations of people being, of members of Congress being less than American. I mean, really, you know, we have to start asking questions about who are these individuals who have set themselves in judgment upon their own colleagues in a way that just not just stifles dissent, but doesn't even permit it. The very base of the Democratic Party, it would seem to be, and historically, has been a wide, voluble, sometimes even wild exertion of an expression of dissent, but that's not happening now. So moving along here, because this, you know, again, this event is worth exploring for its implications. So diplomacy is not to be considered. You go back to 2014 in September, the Minsk agreement that the as a tripartite agreement, which also the OSCE helped to produce. And then Minsk II, a year later, was really aimed at ending the conflict in Donetsk and Luhansk in what is Eastern Ukraine, or was Eastern Ukraine. And if you look at the agreement, it was really, an exercise of diplomacy, but certain interests circling the White House had a different approach. They didn't want diplomacy. They decided to overthrow the government of Ukraine, put in their own individual who they could influence. And what happened from that point on was an escalation of the conflict, first of all, in the Donbass, and over 10,000 people were killed. And these are Russian-speaking people. And at the same time, this debate arises about, is Ukraine going to be accepted into NATO? As we know later on, NATO didn't want them, and the U.S. wasn't going to push it. And so Ukraine was used as a chessboard in an international game of power, unfortunately, at the expense of the lives of the Ukrainian people. Who have never been really given a fair chance to escape this this horror of aggressive war that was catalyzed by partners outside their territory. So, you know, where does this go? If we don't believe in diplomacy anymore, where do we go as a country? Think about this for a minute. It was 60 years ago to this time that President John F. Kennedy and the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev came together and resolved the conflicts that could have led to World War III in what was historically referred to as the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy's inaugural speech is worth considering here. If you look at the words, he says, let us not negotiate out of fear. Let us never fear to negotiate. What does that mean? That means that as the United States of America, since we are major players in this conflict in Ukraine, we have given close to over $60 billion to the Ukrainian government in various forms. How much it was delivered is anybody's guess, but that's the commitment the U.S. has made. Why would we believe that the force of our arms is somehow more significant than the force of our intellect, of our reason? Why do we rely more on arms than our brains? It really is a moment for reflection as to who we are as a country. And have we caught the advancing tide of geopolitical movement, which is away from a unipolar moment, which is more towards cooperation and a multipolar type world where there's not one center of power? We can no longer insist that it's our way or the highway. It's very dangerous and it's very expensive. And so I'm speaking out because, yes, you're right. I led the effort against the Iraq war, and there were 125 Democrats who voted against it. And there were many who voted against continuing appropriations. And I led the effort against the Libyan war and another number of other conflicts, because I just see the stupidity of it. Also, excuse me, the lies that were told to the American people behind those efforts. So, we're in a moment of danger right here. And the congressional, the members of Congress who were basically swept aside for their opinions really represent a lot of Americans who've been raising questions about where's this whole thing going.
And you mentioned, you leading opposition to the war on Libya. That was a war carried out by a president from your own party, by President Obama, who was a Democrat. And now you have a situation where Democrats seem on Ukraine unwilling to challenge Biden in any meaningful way. I mean, this is a counterfactual, but do you think if we were under a President Trump right now, overseeing a similar policy, do you think the Democratic stance in Congress would be the same, supporting it fully?
I mean, one cannot discount that partisan considerations attend any major political decision. You're right that Democrats lined up primarily behind President Obama. But there are also a number of Democrats who lined up, including the leader, the Democratic leader at the time, Richard Gephardt, who lined up with President Bush in the attack on Iraq. Yes, partisan politics can play a role. If President Trump was in right now, given the level of polarization that exists in this country, I think that you'd find that many Democrats would find a reason to oppose the action that a Trump presidency would take, even if it was similar to what we know now the Biden presidency is taking. There's a larger question here, beyond where are we going with this war. What now is America's role in the world? What is the appropriate role for the United States in the world? Is it to be the policeman of the world? Is it to stand astride the events of our time like a colossus, or worse than that, a cyclops who swings wildly and occasionally hits a mark that creates damage to oneself? See, this is the discussion we need to have. This goes way beyond discussions of war and peace. It's about who we are as a nation. Where do we see ourselves in the world community? And what can we do to start to find ways of demonstrating the understanding that the world is indeed interdependent, it is interconnected. And if we shut ourselves off as a nation from the rest of the world community, namely Russia, China, Brazil, India, South America, or excuse me, South Africa, Saudi Arabia, I mean, there's affiliations being created right now, which actually you know, are not only against America's interests, but they but juxtaposed with our policies right now, we're isolating ourselves from an emerging new world. And it's old thinking. You know, we have to realize the world's changing. And why should America be stuck with 19th century thinking in the 21st century?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, so many Democrats who are now voting in lockstep with Republicans to fund the proxy war in Ukraine were earlier critical of U.S. policy in Ukraine. You had Congress overwhelmingly approving a measure in 2018 banning all assistance to the Azov Battalion, which is a neo-Nazi paramilitary force inside Ukraine. Now all that seems to be forgotten. Ilhan Omar put out a statement back in March saying that, you know, flooding Ukraine with billions of dollars worth of weapons could lead to terrible consequences. And now she's denouncing people, protesters who said the same thing to her, as spreading Russian talking points. So what do you think has happened to these progressive members of Congress over such a short period of time?
I don't think members of Congress, whatever caucus they're in, are immune from the larger messaging that's happening in our media culture. So, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of messaging that implies that that somehow Russia needs to be, the government needs to be overthrown, that some people believe, you know, Russia needs to be destroyed as an entity. You know, and when you sit in front of your TV and watch the carnage that comes from the battlefields across Ukraine, nobody's going to have any warm and fuzzy feelings for Russia. I mean, frankly, it's impossible. If you just deluged with that day in and day out. But do you think Americans know how this started? No. Do they understand what happened in 2014 when the U.S. engineered a coup and overthrew the Ukrainian government? Do they understand that it was the U.S. that was helping to fund efforts that ended up in Russian-speaking Ukrainians in the eastern part of the country being killed? No, people don't know that.
But do members of Congress not know that?
Let's continue. Members of Congress who, you know, may rely strictly on the media for their own information about what's going on, although there's many other sources, might just go along with it. It's the same thing that happened to many during Iraq. Now, I'm not excusing it, but I'm saying you got to understand how this happens. And people who are in Congress are, some of them are much like their constituents are worried, but you have to go beyond that. You're a leader. You have to think about where your actions, where your votes take the country. And right now, that's not being considered. Democrats are in lockstep for continuing a war, which will lead to expansion of the war. And my call for diplomacy is no different than what President Kennedy was talking about in 1961, what President Nixon was talking about in 72 with respect to China, what President Carter was talking about at the Camp David Accords, what was spoke about by leading diplomats in the Dayton Accords. I mean, you can go on and on. This is not like something that's new to our experience, but what seems to have been forgotten. And, you know, you only have to look at Gore Vidal's work when he wrote this little pamphlet called The United States of Amnesia, is that we're a player in the world in a way that isn't always positive. And when that happens, it's up to Congress to correct the direction of the country. That's not happening right now, except, you know, so yes, some Republicans have voted against funding. And let me just remind your viewers and listeners, Aaron, you cannot simultaneously say you are against the war and vote to fund it.
Yeah. There was an article recently by Fiona Hill, a former White House expert under the Bush and Trump administrations, who wrote that, according to her sources, speaking to U.S. officials, that there was an outline of a peace agreement reached between Ukraine and Russia back in April. And she didn't say what happened to that peace agreement, but we know from other reporting in the Ukrainian media, citing sources close to Zelensky, that Boris Johnson came over from the UK and told Zelensky that if you sign a deal with Putin, we will not back you up on it. And it's not the time to negotiate with Putin. It's the time to press him. And I was surprised that this letter calling on Biden to negotiate with Russia didn't mention that episode, because it did mention some public reporting and some statements from Biden favoring diplomacy. And I'm just wondering if there's a, if you think there's a fear right now in Congress of acknowledging facts that are in the public record that contradict the dominant line that the U.S. Really wants to seek peace inside Ukraine and is doing this in the best interest of the Ukrainian people.
Well, you've just described an example of he who pays the piper calls the tune. And what we're looking at is not just the discussions that happened in April, but you go back almost a half a year earlier, Russia started discussions. They wanted to meet and find a way to settlement. And this was in December of 2021. Now, look, you know, once the United States conjures an enemy, and you know, I saw this firsthand in Iraq, Saddam Hussein, in Libya with Gaddafi, in Syria with Assad, and on and on and on. When you make that enemies of the month or the enemies of the year club, all hell breaks loose, and the goal is then to wipe you out. Okay. Now, the blowback nobody thinks about. I mean, you could look at the U.S. sanctions and how they have actually resulted in people in Europe freezing this winter, and you will find and had a direct relationship to the increased price of gas over the summer, which of course has had a knock-on effect in fueling inflation. I mean, you know, it's like we haven't really had a moment for reflection about how our actions are having an effect that's reverse of what we thought it would be. And that meeting that you talk about in April, you know, the president of Ukraine is simply, you know, he's boxed in. He's going to do what he's told. And that's why this idea that, well, let Ukraine decide. Look, the man who's in that position right now is going to do what he's told by the U.S. And if the U.S. Tells him, don't agree to anything, he's going to do that. He won't agree to anything, even if the carnage across the country continues. And I have to tell you, you know, when I was in Congress, I had a very large Ukrainian constituency and a smaller Russian constituency, and I had the opportunity to visit Ukraine and visit Russia. It is heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking, to see the devastation that's been wrought, and all of these civilians have been killed. It wasn't necessary, could have been and should have been avoided. And it is just another sorry chapter in the failure of leadership, in the failure of diplomacy, in twisted thinking that invites the virus of megalomania. We need to take a totally different direction in the world, and we really need to pay attention to that biblical injunction about blessed are the peacemakers. We have an obligation to the world community to go with these rhythms of change, and not to try to continue to insist on a unipolar world with an American imperium. It doesn't work anymore. We're past that stage.
The leader of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, blamed some staffers for this debacle, saying that the letter was released without proper vetting. Do you buy that excuse?
I think that Congresswoman Jayapal has been put in an extraordinary position. And I, you know, I'm not going to dispute her account. I don't have any, you know, information to the contrary. But I do want to say the fact that it would come to this kind of consideration where she would be put in this position takes us to the larger question about what is happening with the Democratic Party tries to squeeze out people of goodwill, people who want to see an end to a war which has killed over 15,000 Ukrainian civilians and tens of thousands of Ukrainian troops and Russian troops. What's wrong with a simple request? And so for that and her work, she is being chastised and even castigated by Democratic leaders. I want to say to her that thank you for trying. And it's been an instructive moment when we see how you and 29 other members of Congress have been treated for your efforts on behalf of a peaceful resolution. Thank you, Congresswoman Jayapal, for at least making the effort. But look, as somebody who served in there, I understand totally what's going on there. And I am I'm opposed to the kind of pressure that's being put on members of Congress not to speak their mind in the interest of their constituents and in the interest of America and the world.
I mean, the pressure was, I guess, so strong that people like Jamie Raskin, who signed it, immediately put out a statement welcoming the fact that it was retracted and saying that retracting it was the right decision.
Well, here again, Congressman Raskin, who is a decent person and wants to do the right thing, he came up against this same onslaught. And, he's led various Democratic efforts over the last year. And I think it's pretty clear that when one signs a letter and you're part of the group and you're told you either take your name off that letter, issue another statement, or have the letter retracted, another statement's going to be made. And so it's really important to move away from a discussion about the individuals here and go to the larger question: where is this going? Who are we in the world? How can we find a way not just to settle this conflict, this war, to heal things in the region? There have been many different suggestions about how to do that, and to move from that into a condition where we understand that the world's changing and we're no longer trying to muscle other nations, like China, for example, over Taiwan. It can do no good for the United States and our own security for us to continue to to participate in that widening gyre of chaos, which leads to war. The first thing that we need to do is to quit describing a stand for peace as anti-war, because that semantic construction carries with it the kind of polarity that we're seeking to avoid. Because war really is an expression of polarized thinking. Us versus them, whoever they are. We really need, as individuals and collectively, to begin to see the world as one, to see the world as interconnected and interdependent. And our goal should be human unity, not homogenized, not that we're seeing the world merge into one econotechnic system, to respect all cultures and the diversity of cultures. But we need to reformulate what this movement is about to protect humanity, to create human and ecological security, because it's about the planet in which we live too, which war could destroy, because war is ecocide. So, we are at an inflection point right now in the history of this country and in human history, where we have an opportunity to create anew the world, to create the kind of world that we'd be proud to give to our children, our grandchildren, and their children. But we cannot do that through squelching dissent. We cannot do that through ignoring initiatives to encourage diplomacy, to bring about settlement of conflicts. we are enjoined by the scriptures to make peace with our brothers and our sisters. It's a good time to start thinking about that.
Let me ask you about what Congress can do institutionally in terms of restoring congressional oversight. After the Iraq War, I think there was a recognition inside the halls of power in Washington that, you know, sending off tens of thousands of U.S. troops and then thousands come home in body bags is just not sustainable in order to sustain public support. So there's been a real acceleration in covert warfare. We saw that in Syria, multi-billion dollar program, Timber Sycamore, in support of the insurgency to overthrow the government there. And in Ukraine, too, you have tens of billions of dollars being spent without very much accountability. How difficult is it in Congress to manage to do some oversight of these covert programs, like in Syria and now in Ukraine? And what can be done to restore some congressional oversight of these massive expenditures, these disastrous programs?
Well, first of all, congressional oversight begins with one congressperson and one vote. You can say no. You can vote against continuing appropriations to fuel a war. There's also mechanisms for oversight involving the Committee on Government Oversight. And I was a member of that committee for 16 years. I was chairman of a subcommittee investigating the meltdown on Wall Street. And Congress, I have a feeling, if the Republicans take Congress, which it appears that they will, I think they'll be prompted, if for no other reason than partisan reasons, to look into where the money has gone with respect to Ukraine. I mean, I've seen reports that suggest that perhaps as much as 70% of money, arms that goes over there is somehow diverted. Don't be shocked. In one of my first committee meetings in 1997, an inspector general gave a report that over $1 trillion of Pentagon spending could not be accounted for. During Iraq, there was famously a $9-10 billion tranche of money that just disappeared. You start throwing that kind of money out after things, you're going to, corruption is inevitable. And Ukraine, prior to this war, as a government, did not have a reputation for integrity, to put it mildly. So, you have to.
Dennis Kucinich, former Democratic member of Congress from Ohio and former mayor of Cleveland. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Aaron.
That was Aaron Maté interviewing former Ohio Congressperson Dennis Kucinich. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
You're listening to WGRN 94.1, Columbus Community Radio, The Green Renaissance.